Welcome to Stories of Stories. I'm your host, Mike Chin. In each edition of this podcast, I explore the stories behind a specific creative project, process, or experience. I'll be talking about projects on this show with the expectation that either you're already familiar with the project I'm talking about, so for example, if it's a story, you've already read it, or you don't plan to read it. Regardless, what I'm trying to get at is this podcast will include all kinds of spoilers, so you shouldn't listen if you don't want anything spoiled. This month's episode is a little bit different. I'll be discussing 45th Parallel. 45th Parallel is a literary magazine based out of Oregon State University that I was a part of co-founding. Now, for most of the projects I talk about on this show, it's something that I personally created, and that's where a distinction is really warranted on this one. In particular, I want to cite my friend Alana Folsom. She was kind of the main driving force behind starting 45th Parallel. I think I contributed, you know, a fair amount to starting the project. I think for everything that I did, she probably did at least two things. And so I'm in part telling our story from my perspective and some of the pieces from before the magazine got started. But I'll add that caveat. And when I refer to Alana throughout the course of this podcast, you'll know who I'm talking about now. So this project, in many ways, the seeds for it were planted in a literary magazine seminar that both Alana and I and a number of MFA students were a part of at Oregon State during our winter term in 2015. It was taught by Elena Passarello, who's a great essayist and a fantastic teacher who I had the pleasure of working with a couple times during my time at Oregon State. And throughout that class, we learned a lot about the literary magazine kind of market at the time. It was something where I had already started submitting to journals, and I don't think that I'd really fully understood, though, kind of the larger picture of, you know, what literary journals were, you know, which ones were more credible than others and why, and kind of the tradition behind them and different styles that different journals represented and all of those pieces. So I think, you know, coming out of that class, I think that I and I think, you know, a lot of my classmates learned a lot about literary magazines, and kind of the way that I portrayed it is, you know, coming out of that class, I feel like I know like 10% of what there is to know about literary magazines relative to coming into that class, and I feel like I knew about 1% of what there is to know about literary magazines. So, you know, I was far from an expert coming out of that seminar, but I do feel like I learned a lot coming out of it. And I think one of the underlying sort of purposes for that class, or kind of unspoken truths, was Oregon State didn't have a literary magazine. And that's something where a lot of well-established MFA programs have their own magazines. And it was Oregon State had kind of broached that territory, or arguably crossed it, where it was a little bit weird that we didn't have one. And I think, you know, one of the reasons that a lot of people gave is that, you know, it just wasn't pre-existing. It wasn't something that was already there in the community. And then on top of that, it's a two-year program, and so that's a really short period of time within which to really build something, especially if it's going to be student-driven. You know, if there's more of a faculty leadership, obviously there's more continuity built in there. But if it's something where the students are going to be, you know, starting it and guiding it and editing it, really 2 years is a really short span of time from that first year when people are just getting their feet wet to that second year when people are working on their theses. There's just not a lot of time to actually, you know, create something new and build an institution around it in any sort of meaningful way. But one of the things I really loved about that class is that I sort of feel like our instructor, our professor, Elena, really left things relatively open-ended about how the class would finish. I think in part because there was this, you know, unspoken thing of like, could we start our own magazine, or, you know, what would it entail to do that? Is there an interest in doing that? So, you know, we talked about how we could kind of gain some real world experience, how we could actually produce something coming out of this class. And I had kind of the brainstorm of this thing that I had tentatively called All Things Small. And it was sort of built to work for our class, with the idea being that we would have this literary journal that we had a really short submission window of like something like a week. We asked only for really short work like flash and, you know, line limited poetry and all of that. With the idea being, it'd be something where we could get the experience of, you know, really editing a journal, but all truncated down to this really short period of time with really short material. So I created this. You know, it wasn't exactly elaborate as a pitch, but was elaborate for only having spent about, you know, 24 hours thinking about it, but, you know, kind of presented it to the class and, you know, started to get some buy-in. And then, you know, after, you know, about 10, 15 minutes of conversation, then started to get some serious pushback from folks who felt the idea wasn't as realistic. You know, and it's one of those things where it's, you know, I think if everybody had kind of bought in, I think the parameters around it were realistic, but it was a lot to expect that everyone would buy into it, you know, when we had, you know, whatever it was, 3 or 4 weeks left in the term and things were kind of winding down. So the idea ultimately was kind of tabled, and I had it in mind that it was something that, you know, in the longer term that I would want to pursue, and I would kind of put it on the shelf for myself. And in the meantime, we created more of an in-house kind of production where we just listed work from within the MFA community and from undergraduate students and from faculty, and created something that we just kind of, you know, put out within Moreland Hall, the building where the School of Writing, Literature, and Film was housed. So that seemed to kind of be the end of it, but I had this idea of, you know, bringing back All Things Small, and then as the spring term kind of came into being and as it kind of moved along, I got it in my head that I had it on my to-do list, like, okay, I'm going to just, you know, kind of put the word out there to the whole MFA community here about this idea. A lot of people, you know, weren't in that class, some of them were, but kind of float this idea of, would this be a cool thing? Would people like to work with me on this project? So literally, you know, had it on my to-do list that for the weekend when I had a little bit of time, I was going to carefully craft an email and, you know, gather up email addresses and send it out to everybody. When, you know, just a few days before I had that on my list coming up, I got an email from Alana where she was trying to gather up people to start her own magazine, or I shouldn't really say her magazine, but rather, you know, one for our community. And, you know, it was one of those things where it was like, huh, if I had sent that email out a little bit earlier, you might things have gone in a different direction. In some ways, I'm glad I didn't, because actually I think Alana's vision for this magazine, particularly in kind of the open-ended nature of it, was a really good thing for it. I think the scheme I had around All Things Small was very specific to, you know, a project that would not be overly time-consuming, that would not be something that would, you know, take a lot of resources necessarily. And I think Alana's kind of approach to it was to have a much more open mind about what we might accomplish and, you know, what our goals for a magazine might be, and being collaborative with folks about that. So you know, after that initial email, we started to meet as a group of people who are interested in it. We had a, you know, a significant number of people from the MFA program who, you know, got in on that. And, you know, one of those first decisions that comes up for, you know, this publication, for a lot of publications, I imagine, was just naming it. You know, what are we going to call this thing? And it was interesting how contentious that was. I think just because there were a lot of ideas, and, you know, what the name of something is, especially when you have a group of creative people, a group of writers working on it, isn't an insignificant thing. And we could have tabled it and come back to it, but I think everyone just kind of wanted to know, you know, what this thing would be called. So you know, there were a number of names, some better than others, that kind of got tossed around there, but we settled on 45th Parallel. It works on a number of levels. So just in terms of geography, you know, Corvallis in Oregon is located very nearby the 45th parallel. That's just kind of the halfway point between the North Pole and the equator. And just kind of on a more metaphorical level, it kind of represented some of what our staff was interested in terms of representing intersectionality and hybrid work. Those are kind of sexy terms in the literary world at that time. I think they have been for a long time. It just, everyone kind of feels like their generation is, you know, more innovative around all of that. But it was a name that I think everyone could kind of get behind. There were no real objections to it, and I think kind of a cool name, and I think kind of representative of what we wanted to do, as well as just a geographic identity of, you know, where we were coming from. And then on a functional level, also just with a number name, that actually, you know, put us toward the top of a lot of alphabetical lists, listing journals, and that was you know, something that we talked about briefly in that process as well. So beyond that, though, there were also a lot of questions around what the structure of this magazine would be, like who would be involved, because it was kind of based out of our MFA program, but the way things are set up at Oregon State, the MFA and the MA, Master of the Arts programs, are really intertwined. They work as a cohort in terms of getting their background to work as teaching assistants for the programs, and they share office space, so there's a lot of overlap there. And it's funny, because I remember I was actually a little resistant to the idea. I was a little bit, I think, kind of ego-driven about this being an MFA project, as kind of these things traditionally are for MFA programs, and I'm really glad that's something I was convinced otherwise of, and there were some really great people from the MA program who I think contributed a lot of ideas, and I think that that's part of where the magazine kind of started to develop a little bit different identity, just in terms of how we thought about things, in developing a comics section from the early going that isn't necessarily a part of every literary magazine. I think that was a real strength as things turned out. There were also things like deciding on what positions we would have, for example, I remember campaigning pretty hard for us to have a social media manager, and a part of that is very much rooted in just kind of the best interest of the magazine, that I feel like social media is such a piece of how any organization markets itself, how it recruits readers, how it gets staff involved as a literary magazine, how we appeal to writers. When I choose literary journals to submit to, one of the things that I will look at is how many Twitter followers or Facebook likes does this page have? Not that that's a be-all end-all, and there are definitely some outliers that are not great magazines that have a ton of followers, as well as some really reputable places, really impressive publications that don't have much of a social media presence. But especially for those journals that I'm just less familiar with, that can be a telltale sign of what kind of organization this is. So having someone who was focused on social media, I did feel was important. There's also kind of my dirty little secret around it, which I don't think I've really talked about with anyone, which is I was trying to carve out a spot for myself. I wanted to make sure that I had a position. We did this process where we put positions we were interested in into this collective spreadsheet, and got a sense of who would be running against whom and all of that. And some of it was just strategic of I had visions of wanting to be the managing editor for this organization, working directly with Alana and kind of leading it. My vision is maybe being the fiction genre editor, thinking that that could be a really good experience to just kind of set me up for more editing work in the future. And social media manager was kind of, I feel like I'm fairly in tune to social media, and then just kind of shoring up that this could be a spot that I could have if nothing else panned out. So as it turned out, I did end up becoming the managing editor, and and we had very capable people filling all these other roles, including social media manager. But I was glad it was a thing that was included when we started up. So after those initial steps, there were a lot of other processes, and largely ones that I think Alana was much more kind of instrumental in getting up and running. One of the main ones was just looking for money. Alana was really good about applying for grants and being creative about it. It's one of those things where you might kind of look at grant writing as one of those kind of soul-sucking things that is not a creative process. But it was things like seeking out opportunities. So for example, we applied for this one grant that was dedicated towards green initiatives on the basis that we would print our journal on 100% recycled paper. Something as simple as that is a little outside the box, that particular one didn't pan out, but just the idea of kind of looking down different avenues and trying to get resources. So another key component of starting this journal was operating within the structure of a university. So we had an idea of kind of operating independently. We would obviously have some level of tie to Oregon State, just for staffing concerns, that we wanted to be a student-based organization, and also just for credibility. Being attached to a high-profile MFA program obviously gave us a leg up over just being a journal that some miscellaneous folks threw together. But that brought up a lot of questions around, if we really would operate independently, including financially. There was a point when we'd applied to be a student organization, and there were also a lot of questions about, would we just be a part of the School of Writing, Literature, and Film at Oregon State? And being a part of the university in one capacity or another offers up a lot of resources. You know, there's the university name, and again, in this case, the MFA program to go with that. There's money that goes with that. There's the capacity to have faculty mentorship, all of those pieces. But then it also comes with some pieces like losing some autonomy. And so, you know, knowing that if it's going to have the MFA program's name attached to it, there's going to be at least some faculty input for, you know, what goes in the journal or what does not. And there were some growing pains related to that, especially as we did become, you know, more closely intertwined with the department. And if it decided to, you know, have that be an official partnership, it was this real back and forth process where I think the department itself was kind of unsure. And there was a new faculty member joining the department who was assigned the role of kind of being our liaison. And then that evolved into being, you know, more of our advisor, if not our, you know, kind of partner with the editor in chief. He was a great partner. I'm going to leave his name out of it just to kind of protect the innocent on this, but someone I had a real pleasure working with. I feel like I learned a lot from in this process. But in any event, all of this resulted in a number of these growing pains and some disputes. There were things like we launched a crowdfunding campaign to raise money to do our first issue, to make it a print issue. And when there was serious money that became involved, as our advisor kind of let us know, you know, once you start really having real money, that's when people start paying real attention to you. And so that came with some scrutiny because that's not a viable revenue stream for a university organization. The university has its own ways of collecting money from donors and whatnot, but using something like a Kickstarter campaign is not a viable means to do that. So that was kind of one of those big early stumbling blocks that came not even that early in the process. We were kind of getting ready to go to have an issue, but ultimately had to agree to relinquish all of the money and, you know, return it to the donors and cancel the crowdfunding campaign in order to officially seal our partnership with the university. So if you stumbled upon this podcast, if you're not just one of, you know, my friends or family who listens, I realize you might be thinking about these things, about kind of how these logistics work of starting a literary magazine, and especially doing so within the context of a university or within a program. So these are some of the pieces that are worth thinking about and just kind of worth asking questions and worth getting plans in writing. I think that's one piece where I think we were, you know, very well organized, all considered, but I think that's one of those things that in retrospect, you know, we might have gotten, you know, more things settled and in writing earlier on and may have avoided some of the, you know, kind of potholes we ran over later on. But I think all in all, one of the most important takeaways and one of the things I would advise anyone to think about, again, especially if they're working in partnership with a much larger organization, is just to understand that everything is going to take longer than it seems like it logically should. The fact that 45th Parallel actually produced both online and then print issue, barely over a year after we really started thinking about it is truly remarkable. And it's one of those things where I just don't think that it would happen if it weren't for, Alana being so committed and for, numbers kind of, rallying and being pretty organized about things. I think it was kind of a perfect storm of kind of those pieces of effort and organization that made it happen. But that's not necessarily a realistic timeline for something like this to occur. And I should also just mention, I'm not meaning to cut other, kind of co-founders short. There were a lot of, really excellent contributors to starting the journal. And I'm more leaving other names out of this because I know I will forget a number of really important contributors to that process. But these are some people who are, I consider good friends of mine and, really impressive colleagues who contributed a lot. So, no disrespect to any of them who might be listening. This was definitely a team effort. But in any event, I want to talk about, some of the other pieces of just kind of, getting started and working with a journal. One of the pieces that I personally had never experienced before that I think a lot of people had or, will as they enter an MFA program or start working with journals is just reading through the slush pile. So, you know, we got 45th Parallel listed on Duotrope. We got our call for submissions out to, you know, creative writing opportunities lists and on different Facebook pages and kind of all over the place so that we could, you know, have this pool of submissions to read through. And we got some really good solicited work through various connections we had or people we just kind of, you know, reached out to blindly. But we also had some really good stuff from the slush pile. And it was one of the unexpected, you know, both joys and kind of lessons that I got out of this experience. You know, I read through the overwhelming majority of the fiction slush. And for those who aren't initiated to this, I'm sorry to use kind of the technical or the insider term. It's funny to call slush a technical term. But basically, it's just the idea of these submissions that just came in, that weren't, you know, specifically asked for, that were just from, you know, any interested person who saw our call for submissions and was willing to share their work. In reading through all this, you know, I always knew that the slush pile would be uneven. I knew whenever I was submitting that, you know, the odds were against any particular submission getting in anywhere. But, you know, it was striking to me how much of it that I read was quickly rejectable. You know, it came across as clunky or kind of scattered early on. And I feel like I was actually a relatively generous reader for the slush pile, that I would actually read most stories either through to the end or at least, you know, in that 5 to 10 pages within, just to kind of see if things might, you know, turn around or if there were, you know, kernels of something valuable kind of hidden in there that we'd be able to, you know, trim things away or edit things to work. But I found usually, especially in the case of things that we ended up declining, you know, after I'd read the first few paragraphs, I had a pretty strong opinion that it wasn't going to work, and then that opinion very, very rarely changed. Usually it was more something started out well, and so I'd read it through, and then by the end, I ultimately, you know, wanted to pass on it, or, you know, or I was in favor, but, you know, didn't have enough of the group support behind it. But it was striking how many, you know, didn't start out so well, and that's where they ended up. They didn't end up getting in. You know, and it affected, you know, how I think about my own submissions. And I think that's part of why I would really recommend to any aspiring writer that while it's really important to be reading good things, I think this process of reading the slush is really helpful in kind of holding up a mirror to your own work. And seeing, you know, just, you know, if you're submitting, not to be offended by rejection, because when people say that, you know, their journal only accepts, you know, 5% of submissions, that's probably completely accurate, because a lot of the work just is not ready for that caliber of magazine, or not a fit, at least culturally, is what that magazine is trying to do. And then beyond that, there is kind of that subsection of, you know, work that is good, but still is just not going to find a spot based on limited number of pages or limited space or, you know, a ceiling on number of pieces that a journal wants to accept. So I think also that process just helped me to write better stories, frankly, just by seeing where a lot of these stories were coming up short. It helped me focus my work a little bit more about making sure that, you know, things were getting off to a strong start and then keeping it up and how to do that. And some of the value of, for example, just writing short pieces, you know, for a piece that's, you know, well over 5,000 words, it's got to be great for anyone to want to publish it, just because that's a much longer piece just for the editor alone to read through, let alone to get, you know, a consensus that the editors want to accept this thing and to have space to do it. In any event, you know, 45th Parallel on the whole, you know, it survived to a second year. You know, so we really got things going. We got the issue out there towards the end of our second year in the MFA program. You know, myself, Alana, our whole cohort of people. And it did carry on for another year. The second issue is out. As I'm recording this, there are plans to be a third one. I'm kind of out of the loop on most of that process now. And that's kind of a great thing, right? To know that I didn't have to be a part of it, that a lot didn't have to be a part of it, that there were more than capable people who kind of picked up the reins and took it from there. And now there are people who I've never even met who are taking it on and who are taking on these leadership roles. That's a legacy I think to be proud of, and I think a testament to the quality of the program that I was a part of. So, you know, I think that's a really cool thing that, you know, by the time this podcast actually drops, that third issue may be out. It may not by then, but I think, you know, regardless, that's pretty great. So there's obviously, you know, a lot more to be said about starting a journal and this particular process of starting 45th Parallel. Alana and I had talked about doing some blog posts on the topic. It's something that just kept getting pushed off. Maybe someday we will revisit it. I'm sure she'd have a lot to add. I'm sure if I hadn't thought about it longer, I'd probably have more things to add. But some of the main takeaways, though, I would suggest, again, just if you're someone who is thinking about starting a journal, and that's how you came upon this podcast, one piece is just you can't do it alone. I think the number one reason why 45 Parallel worked was because Alana steering that ship was so collaborative and so interested and willing in bringing people in. And I think that would have been one of the shortcomings had I gotten that email out earlier and started the All Things Small project. I think that's still a viable project I may pursue one day, but kind of having a single person kind of steering things, I think, and trying to make it their own specific vision, I think is really hard if it's going to be a collaborative project. And I think, calling on different resources, calling on different people is really key. And it was key to the success of 45th Parallel. I'd also emphasize patience. Again, just knowing that things aren't going to happen quickly. I think we all needed to be patient just to see this thing through, over the course of a little over a year to get that first issue out. But again, that was lightning fast for this kind of thing to really happen. And so, having to be, patient and being ready to, wait things out. And then this idea of knowing when to push. And I think that, again, is something that I think is largely attributable to, Alana's efforts. But I think a few of us kind of, helped support in this area where, it being a two-year program at Oregon State, there was every reason for this not to work, for us to have these big ideas and for us to get a lot of momentum, and then for it to kind of, die off or at least get deferred and be something that was a project that took, another 2 years to ever see the light of day. And I think, the sense of persistence and trying to push things along and, not accepting that, I think was key to making this a real thing much sooner than otherwise would have been. Okay, so that's a wrap on 45th Parallel for now. So now I'm going to move along to Mike's monthly endorsement. So as an artist, I think it's important to be consuming other things to see what interests and inspires you, and to see what's already out there and see what's come before you. So at the end of episodes, I'm recommending something along the lines of a book or a story or a movie or a TV show or a band or a professional wrestling match that may have escaped the mainstream kind of audience or that may be a little dated and now it's about to be forgotten, but that I want to recommend to folks. So in this episode, I'm going to recommend one story. And this is largely a recommendation for folks outside kind of the literary community, because actually within the literary world, it's a pretty big deal. It's a very high-profile journal. But it's one of those things I'm always checking myself on, that outside the literary world, I don't know that there is such a thing as a well-known literary journal, unless we're going to go to like the New Yorker or the Paris Review, maybe. But one story, it's a very successful, well-celebrated journal with some longevity behind it. But again, it may have escaped kind of everyday folks. Part of what I really like about this journal is just the concept behind it. It is what the title of the journal says that it is, which is one story. Each issue is just one short story that is kind of set aside and published as its own standalone unit in a very kind of humble presentation. It's an inexpensive magazine, and I like kind of that focus, because kind of just with one story that's not very expensive to acquire, that just gets kind of mailed out on a regular basis, it's easy to consume, right? Even if you're someone who doesn't consider themselves an avid reader but has some interest in the literary world, to just get one short story to digest is pretty manageable. Even as someone who does consider himself a pretty avid reader, when I get a big 200 page literary journal in the mail, that's pretty daunting, right? I'm probably going to cherry pick pieces by authors who I already know or that have some buzz around them, or just specific titles that draw me in, or I might just leaf through and see if something jumps out at me. But more often than not, I'm not really reading it cover to cover. But that's something that I think one story really facilitates. It's also just a really kind of ethical organization. I really like that it's a magazine that does pay its writers and pays them well. It's as of this writing, it's $500 for a story, which is a really nice sum, and I think a testament that they respect the work that they're accepting and respect the writers and want to support them. So again, the name of that journal is One Story. Okay, well, I want to thank you all for listening, and I hope you will check back again. Special thanks, as always, go to Mike Peake for providing the theme music for this show. That's all for this time. I'm wishing you all good health, happiness, and creativity, and I'll catch you next time.